You're smart people, so I'm sure you figured out what was wrong with that picture right in the beginning, right? You didn't hear what it is. The cemetery was full, and the building had been abandoned. I guess that church fulfilled its great commission because it managed to bury all of its members.
It was done.
And if they drive anywhere in this country, especially throughout the city, it doesn't take you very long to go drive past another church that looks a lot like that. The building kind of falling apart, tanks, healing, because there's nobody taking care of it anymore. The White Valley, the cemetery is full. This has been a year of talking about community. We look at Acts chapter 2 to understand the community of the 31st church. Then we got in our time machine and we took a jump to the book of Revelation and looked at Jesus and which we have a community. Then we were done there, we went back in our time machine and we took a jump way back in time to the book of Genesis where we took a voyage to Noah. Who was desperately trying to save the world. His community. So, where do we go next? Well, we're going to jump a little forward in time, but just a few thousand years, we're not coming all the way back to the start. We're going to find ourselves right landing in the book of Proverbs, chapter 6, verses 15 through 19. Listen very carefully. There are six things the Lord hates. And seven that are detestable to him. Haughty eyes, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked schemes, feet that are quick to rush into evil, a false witness who pours out lies, and a person who stirs up conflict in the, there is our word, community. This is not the very first time that we've found ourselves landing in the book of Proverbs. Proverbs was written by, King Solomon. Yep, he's the one that last year we chased the wind with him, trying to figure out how to catch the perfect wife. And well, Proverbs is essentially a manual for living life. Proverbs chapter 6, Proverbs chapter 1, verses 1 through 6, something like that. And it also tells us, beginning on verses 8 and 9, that Proverbs was specifically written to Solomon's son. So what Proverbs is an advice column from wise Solomon to his son about how you go about living life. Time hasn't changed much, but guess what? In case you were wondering, Solomon's son didn't listen to him. He went everywhere else that he could possibly think, and it ended up dividing the kingdom of Israel. And maybe you're thinking, so for us, what does this have to do with community? But we've been studying all year long. Other than the word of action here at the very end of the sermon, at the very end of the passage, so the thing is, it says that God has seven things that, six things that he hates, the one that he finds acceptable. And when I think about what God might hate, I can think of all kinds of sins that I would fill in the blank with, right? And here's the problem. The sins that I would make God hate, ain't on that list. And the reason is because the things that God hates isn't exactly about sin. It's about things that kill the community. Now, I call them community killers because these are things that if you find them prominent in the church or in your life, it will literally rip you apart from the inside out. We have this notion in our world today that all the enemies of the church, all the problems of the church are coming from the outside in, and Solomon is here to tell us that your problems. Funny, we're coming back to that moment, right? They're from the inside. There are things that you find in the church or in your body or in your life that literally are going to cause issues because they're part of your life. Therefore, for the next 6 weeks, we want to understand what they are. And then come to the heart part. We want to acknowledge when we see them in ourselves and in our body. Then comes the even harder part. We want to grasp how they go about killing the community. How do they negatively impact our church and our body and our lives? And do they actually kill our community with one another and with God? Then comes the part where we want to learn how to deal with them in a biblical fashion. And a lot of times I don't think we do that. We see these things, and it makes us mad, it makes us frustrated. And then the funny thing is, in dealing with the things with killing the community, you know what we do? We do the exact same things that they're doing that are killing the community, and then we create more division and more problems and more issues, and we are literally ripping the church apart. So I've got 6 weeks set up how to do this. Obviously, there are 7 things there, so somewhere along the line, you know that I combine 2. The good thing is there are 2 that fit really good together. So I got that figured out. So let's just start right where Solomon starts. Holy eyes. What does that mean? I mean, he takes the word eyes, and I know what my eyes are, and he puts that word talky in front of it. Good word for talky. Talky eyes. So he can say it in an accent. And well, the dictionary definition is blatantly or disdainfully proud. Having or showing an attitude of superiority and contempt for people or things perceived to be superior. This is not the first time we've discussed this term talky. In Proverbs chapter 16, verse 18, it says, pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before fall. Here it is connected with the spirit, but it is also connected with this word. There it is. The word haughty is used 5 times in Proverbs. 3 times it is related to the eyes. Once here, Proverbs chapter 6, verse 16. Also in Proverbs chapter 21, verses 2 through 4, this is regretted. A person may think their own ways are right, but the Lord weighs the heart. To do what is right and just is more acceptable to the Lord than sacrifice. Haughty eyes and a proud heart, the unplowed fields of the wicked produce sin. He also compares it to eyes there in Proverbs chapter 30, verses 11 through 14. There are those who curse their fathers and do not bless their mothers. Those who are pure in their own eyes and yet are not cleansed of their filth. Those whose eyes are even so haughty, whose glances are disdainful, whose teeth are sore, and whose jaws are set with knives, to devour the poor from the earth and the needy from among mankind. And as I read verses 21 to chapter 21 and to verses in chapter 30, I came to a really, really startling conclusion. It's hard for me to see it anymore. It's hard to see pride in myself because verse 21 says that I think I'm doing right. I mean, honestly, I have to always think I'm right. Because if I thought I was wrong, then I changed my mind. Because who in their right mind would walk around knowing they're wrong and continuing to be wrong? I change everything, right? So if I never see it in myself, I never have to make a change. Psalm falls out a little thicker in Mary chapter 30. He says, we think in my mind, I'm sure. But really, I'm ahead of the potential for myself. So the first take I want you to get from all of this is don't take these sermons and just dismiss them. Therefore, the person that they don't go to church. Therefore, the person that's not me because I don't have a pride issue. And if you think that, then guess what? You have a pride issue. So, what exactly are haughty eyes? Well, they're the kind of eyes that look down at other people as if one looking down is higher up than others. So it's kind of funny, I'm standing up here on stage today, and y'all are all sitting at the main level, so it looks very easy, but I have to look down. I'm up here all by myself, and the focus of the attention. on me, and y'all just kind of sitting out there, right? This is the picture of what party God looks like when you get a part of the fire in the life. I'm the center stage, I'm the focal point, I'm the person that you need to pay attention to. By the way, the rest of you guys, you're just out there to do what I want you to do. That's what party God is doing. It's a perfect picture for you. When we begin to think about it, Solomon tells us that you have a negative heart if you have all of us. Everything is always bad. Everything is negative. You have to complain about everything and grouse about everything. Inside of your heart is nothing but just disdain. Jesus said that what comes out of a man is rich love. When you said that you're finished, his name is rich love. He said, you really want to know what's inside of a man? Walk up to him and punch him in the stomach. Whatever it is, will come out really quick. You have to understand that if you have fallen out of this inside, there is nothing but negative. And that negativity gives a judgmental attitude. We look at our viewpoint and we have the us and them mentality. They don't know how to live their life. They have issues. Not like me. Look at me because I go to church. I read into a Baptist church. I read my Bible. I pray. I sing. So they have issues. Therefore, with judgmentalness comes this idea of we become critical. We evaluate everybody else's life and pick all the little bitty pieces out of their life and talk about all the things that they're doing wrong and all the things that are wrong with our world and all the things that need to be fixed and all the things that we want done this way or that way. We just become critical. I love the way Solomon puts it. He says, those who speak are like swords. Dog at 7 times. He just ripped into everything and tear it all apart. Just vicious, viciousness that comes from just a simple thing of being yourself. And then, of course, that leads to the idea of the main plan. Solomon said to devour the poor from the earth, the needy from loving and kind. They're consumers. What's in it for me? I want to get what I can get out of it, and as soon as everything, I've got everything out of it, and I'm going to move on, and you know what? We'll abandon the building and we'll build a cemetery. As long as I got to consume, look at it, and leave. Ouch. Remember, sometimes it's hard to see it in me. And well, when it comes to this, the idea is that there is harmful effects to be part of the other. See, you need to keep in mind it's connected to pride. And remember that statement that the eyes are the windows to the soul? It's safe to say that if you have part of the eyes, it's possible to be part of the prideful heart. And you need to remember it. Pride is the number one sin discussed in the Bible. What? It is the number one sin discussed in the Bible. You can take all the others, you can add them together, and it doesn't even equal how much talk is given to this idea of pride. In fact, pride is the very origin. This is what Satan says to eat. For God knows that when you eat from it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil, and you get what he's saying to there, right? Eat, if you'll just eat it. Eat, if you'll just take it. You can be God. You can have the throne of your own heart, and you get to say what's right and wrong, and you get to say what's good and evil, and you get to say what you want to know, what you don't want to do. You get to be God. Folks, if that ain't pride, I don't know what it is. If you want to control my life, it's pride. Completely chaos. Because you do realize that God doesn't drive a dead car. He doesn't have a steering wheel for you and a steering wheel for him, a brake for you and a brake for him, and y'all are going to fight over the wheel. God says, no. One wheel, one driver, you pick who's it going to be. You drive it, or my driver. And by the way, then comes disgrace. If you're living prideful, at some point, you will disgrace the name of Christ. Proverbs chapter 13, verse 10 says, when there is strife, there is pride. Pride means that everything becomes a battle. You lose the sense of cooperation because you have to have strife because it has to go your way. Proverbs chapter 14, verse 3 says, a fool's mouth lashes out with pride. Arguing, nitpicking, name-calling. Reality, you begin to sound like a fool, especially when you want to try to convince others that your value is following Jesus. I mean, honestly, do you really think you can go out and bring people into a place where arguing with one another all the time? Where they're nitpicking, you can't do it this way, you can't do it that way. You didn't die on this side, you didn't cross this. You know, you crossed it, but your key is across a little bit this way. I like mine to be a little more level when you think you change it. That's what comes of pride. Proverbs chapter 16, verse 6 says, I go before again. Destruction. Literally, it just will rip you out. And finally, we tell this in chapter 29, verse 23, pride brings a person to love. I'll spin around with this a little bit. Talk about how we're supposed to deal with pride. You know the quick answer, right? I need to be more humble. I got to get some humility in my life. And, well, I would like to remind you for a moment. Prideful people never see themselves as prideful. Therefore, prideful people hardly see themselves as humble people. Therefore, trying to teach a prideful person to be humble is kind of like impossible because they're going to tell you I'm already humble. As a matter of fact, usually when you talk to them, they'll tell you just how humble they are. They'll tell you all the great things they do for everybody else. But if they're not exactly comfortable with God, they just can't be taught that way. He said, while Christ was right as far from the sea of me, you know what I had to learn over the years? I didn't even look this up. I didn't even know anything about this. It is very easy for me to see your pride. Matter of fact, just ask me. I'll come and look at your life a little bit, and I'll tell you all the things you're doing in your life that make you prideful. Okay, we can do this. You know how I know we can do this? Because this is what we do. Because if I can focus my attention on your pride, try to get you to fix your pride, whose pride do I not have to worry about? Mine. Because I'm not prideful, because obviously you've got more problems than I got, so we'll just work on yours, and we'll never have to worry about mine, and I'm sure you're seeing how this is cause some issues just by saying it just needs to be more humble. The good news is, in Philippians chapter 2, verses 3 to 8, if you want to grab a copy of God's Word and turn your way there, the Apostle Paul paints a real picture of what true humbleness looks like. He gives us some actions to think about, specifically 3. And interesting enough, all of them connect with how you deal with people. Philippians chapter 2, verses 3 to 8 reads this way: we must have selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourself, not looking at your own interests, but each of you to the interests of others. In your relationship with one another, have the same mindset as Jesus, who being the very nature of God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant. Being made in human likeness and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on the cross. I like Paul's writing because Paul doesn't pull punches. Paul's very blunt, very direct, and right out the chute, he hits you with the big left hook. Do nothing out of selfish ambition. So if you want to really talk about humility, you want to talk about pride, the first thing you have to do is check your motivation. Why are you doing what you're doing? Am I doing what I'm doing because I want somebody to see me do it? Here's one. Am I doing what I'm doing because I want God to be happy with me? You realize that's pride, right? I want to make God happy with me. So therefore, I'm doing what I'm doing, and that's my motivation for doing it. We can identify two motives in talk with this idea of selfish ambition. Focused on you and your wants and desires, and centers on what you can get from a person, place, thing, or situation. First thing Paul brings up is, are you doing this selfish use? So you can get to it. He ties it to the word ambition, which is all about exalting yourself. Usually when we think about ambition, we think about money, right? People that are in, that's not what ambition is. Ambition is, you're out there to get it, and you're out there to get it because you only really care about one person. Okay? That's the selfish ambition. So I could actually be doing the best thing in the world, but I could be doing it for selfish reasons, and therefore, because I'm doing the best thing in the world, I can convince myself that I don't have a prideful ambition. But at the end of it, when I bolt all down that ship away, if the person that's as far as me, then you realize that's my time. I spent a time with God that wants me to live. Selfish ambition is just all about power and control. You're seeking to be in control, to go your own way, and you know what? I can see only me. When my life is full of selfish ambition, the only thing that matters is what I want, what I need, what will make me happy. And that means whether it's a worship service, or whether it's a food service, a fellowship service, or whether it's the way we do service projects, or the way we teach our kids, or what verse of the Bible we translate from the Bible we read. Okay, you get it, right? Of course, it can be easy to call it kind of let up there, but then you can easily change all of that. Let go of the nice white jazz and just kind of punches you right in the middle of it. He says, by the way, why are you looking for that selfish ambition? Be very careful with that remains and see. Because vanity is all about appearance. Conceit is the excessive appreciation of one's own worth for virtue. So I am important. I am important, right? This doesn't work without me, right? Right? I'm the center of the universe, right? I used to make a joke. I had an office, and it was like in the center, and I had four low-bearing walls around my office. So they did a remodel at the building, and they everybody else had to move, and I got to stay in the same office. And I told the person to come, I figured it out. I finally figured out how to make the world revolve around me. And the funny thing is, we spend our life trying to do this, and our church life trying to make the church revolve around me. And what I want, and what I want to do in life, is sit in my office and just call the shots. See, in humility, value others above yourself. Not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of others. The first glimpse that we get of that first century church back in Acts chapter 2, verses 42 through 47, what we did at the beginning of the year. Well, they're not interested in me, they're more interested in we. And it shows. Because if we look at them, they're digging into themselves to meet the needs of others in mind. They're not looking for a program or charity. They're not looking for somebody else to volunteer. They're saying, I think it's my life. Ponder how many times we have said, I think, I want, I believe when it comes to the community of the church. We want all things to be comfortable for us. Well, we work very hard to make it that way. You understand that pride is dated. It's possible that is pride talking. And in that moment, you are more concerned with me and not concerned with others. Let's do some thought. I wish I would have wrote a copy of them off website that I was doing my research on. So the moment I introduce the word I in the middle of anything, you realize I brought my pride with me. So once I introduce I to the middle of it, I'm no longer concerned about me. I don't want it the way that I want. This is why Paul follows up the month of Jazz, the bishop's position. In your relationships, one another, and the mindset of expectations. Think about Paul, and how you want Jesus to do this whole thing. And you see it, right? The action is to set your mind on the Jesus. I can look at the button, okay? But he literally wants you to reach into your mind, to change your mind, and find that setting that says Jesus, and do that. And he says, in case you can't find it, let me help you with how to take the action. Specifically said, when you deal with people in your relationships, be Jesus. Be Jesus. That means when I'm dealing with a conflict at work, I'm supposed to be Jesus. I gotta tell you something. Sometimes I'm not very good at Jesus. I'm good at being embarrassed, but I'm not very good at being Jesus. When I'm dealing with any relationship in the church, I'm supposed to be being Jesus. When I deal with my kids, I'm supposed to be being Jesus. When I deal with my wife, I'm supposed to be being Jesus. And all of my relationships, I'm supposed to be being Jesus. And how do I be Jesus? Well, I'll call that for you. Be a servant. He said he made himself nothing, taking on the very nature of servant. And we know what a servant is. A servant is one that serves others. One that performs duty about the personal home of a master or a personal employer. A servant, if you slice it, they're not in charge. And I guess that's sort of charge things by the past a little bit. We must follow the wishes of our Jesus and the wishes of our master's employees. And that's all. I mean, really? I'm supposed to treat the church center. I'm not standing on the stage, and I'm up here and you're down there. I'm supposed to be down there also. I'm supposed to be serving. You're not doing this for you. You're doing this for God. I think I'm going to put up. Okay, we'll back that off. We'll just do this for God. Now, this is doing this for God. Colossians chapter 3, verse 17. Whatever you do, whether in word or deed, do it all in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, give you thanks to God the Father for him. Galatians chapter 5, verse 13 says, you, my brothers and sisters, are called to be free, but do not use your freedom to indulge the flesh. Rather, serve one another and love the Lord. We're supposed to take on the mindset of a servant. That means it's a task of it. I'm physically able to do it. And while he's not done, because he's got to hit you with the one-two jab, and the little cross that he's supposed to be, or he's going to have to be obedient. Even if it kills you, isn't that what Jesus did? I mean, isn't this really about living in the Catholic picture? His entire life, Jesus lived to the benefit of others. Even in his death, he died to the benefit of others. Living in sacrifice, sacrificially, he said, and his entire sermon comes from a very dominant point. Remember I told you that part I was going to expand on later? Here's the thing, man. We have a choice. Either we can humble ourselves before we admit Isaiah chapter 2, verse 3, verse 18, God be with us. He looks at the word. The eyes of the arrogant will be humbled. And human pride will oppose. The Lord alone will be exalted in that day. The Lord Almighty has a day in store for all the proud and lofty, for all that is exalted, and they will be humbled. For all the cities of Lebanon, tall and lofty, and all the oaks of Bashan, for all the towering mountains and all the high hills, for every lofty tower and every fortified wall, for every trading ship and every stately vessel, the arrogance of man will be brought low. The Lord alone will be exalted in that man. And the idols. You get your choice, right? We can figure out in our community today how to live home, how to have that mindset of Jesus. Or you can take the lesson today and see your time. And God comes back and says, you know what? I'm that day, you will be healed. Matter of fact, we're told that every knee is going to bow, every tongue is going to confess. There is going to be a debate about who's in charge. God is God, and on that day, you will have to be healed. We can abandon the building all we want. But you can't stay out. And God says, you can't live your life in the light of Christ.